This podcast is sponsored by the FG Barnes Group, with showrooms in Canterbury and Maidstone, offering a range of new and approved used cars, including MG, Seat and Vauxhall. Kent Online News.
News you can trust.
This is the Kent Online Podcast. Ishmael Khawaja.
Hello, hope you're doing well and are all set for the big festive weekend. It's Wednesday, the 23rd of December. Thanks for downloading today's podcast. Coming up, there's a warning about travel disruption as drivers start their Christmas getaway, and a man who contracted TB while sleeping rough is hoping his story will change the way homeless people are treated. But first, a man in his 50s has died following a crash on the M20. He was driving an Audi which collided with two other vehicles on the London-bound stretch yesterday evening. It meant the motorway had to be shut for more than 14 hours. Well, crash investigators have given us a statement. Lucy's been reading it.
At 5:57pm on Thursday, 22nd of December, a white Volvo lorry, a blue Peugeot and a grey Audi were involved in a collision at Junction 4 of the London-bound M20 near New Hythe. Officers attended along with South East Coast Ambulance Service, and a man in his 50s was pronounced dead at the scene. Kent Police's Serious Collision Investigation Unit are carrying out inquiries. Anyone who saw what happened or has dashcam footage of the moments leading up to the collision should call or email.
Thanks for those details, Lucy.
Kent Online reports.
Our other top stories today. A man's been charged with murder following a stabbing in Sittingbourne. Police were called to a property off College Road in the early hours of Wednesday, and 40-year-old David Perry was pronounced dead at the scene. An 18-year-old was arrested and at the time of recording was due in court today. Police say four asylum seekers who died in the Channel were in a dinghy which was wholly unsuitable to make the crossing from France to Kent. An inquest heard two were from Afghanistan and the others from Senegal, but their identities are still unknown. Their provisional cause of death has been given as drowning. 39 others were rescued when the small boat capsized in the freezing waters off Dungeness last Wednesday. The inquest has been suspended due to the ongoing criminal investigation. A 19-year-old man is due in court next month, accused of piloting the boat. Two men have been arrested after armed police were called to Chatham. There were reports of a person with what appeared to be a firearm on Ingle Road yesterday. Officers sealed off the area and want to speak to the driver of a dark-coloured vehicle which was nearby at the time.
Kent Online reports.
Now, it's been confirmed nurses in Kent and Medway will be part of national strikes for the first time in the new year. The Royal College of Nursing says there will be new walkouts at hospitals across much of England on the 18th and 19th of January. It follows two days of action this month over pay. Liz is a former nurse at East Kent Hospitals Trust.
The staffing level has been a major issue for years. Chronic underfunding, chronic lack of representation as nursing is a credible profession. We do way more than anybody else in the community, in the hospitals, in the hospices. It's the nurses that do all the work. And I mean all the nurses, the care assistants, the associate practitioners, the students, the return to work nurses, the foreign nurses. We are the glue and the oil that keep the wards running. And I don't think anybody actually recognises just what a toll that is emotionally, professionally, especially when you are constantly badgered to make bad decisions that aren't in your patient's best interest or the ward's best interest. They keep going about it the wrong way. They talk about recruitment and retention, but frequently the focus is on recruitment. But that's backwards, because if you solve retention, you don't have a recruitment problem. And the only way you can have retention is to look after your staff. So all the time that we are short-staffed, we are not being looked after. It's an obligation by the trust under health and safety, and they're meant to protect us at work. And it's a duty that fail everywhere. And it's the same with the ambulance crews. It's the same with the physios. It's the same with the doctors. It's the same with the dentists. There are more vacancies than people applying. And that's a bad equation. The government need to solve it.
Prime Minister Rishi Sunak says his hands are tied when it comes to salaries.
I'm really sad and I'm disappointed about the disruption that is being caused to so many people's lives, particularly at Christmas time. When it comes to, you know, the difficult question of setting public sector pay, the government has acted fairly and reasonably in accepting all the recommendations of the public sector pay review bodies.
Meanwhile, a planned strike by ambulance workers between Christmas and New Year has been called off, with the GMB union declaring it's received amazing public support, but it's scheduling another one for January 11th. Paramedics and call handlers from SeaCam, which covers Kent, will be involved. Staying with health news, and bosses at Medway Maritime Hospital in Gillingham have stood down a critical incident that was declared yesterday, but warned they remain under considerable pressure. A number of non-urgent services and outpatient operations were rescheduled to free up staff to meet extremely high levels of occupancy. The Trust says it's expecting to face further challenges in the near future, suggesting more measures may need to be implemented over the Christmas period. A Medway mum whose son caught strep A says it's taken her almost a week to get hold of antibiotics. Sarah Zara's seven-year-old boy was diagnosed last Wednesday, and her younger children have also had scarlet fever symptoms. She looked for medication in more than 25 pharmacies across Medway, Dartford and parts of London before finally finding some. The government insists that there's no national shortage.
This podcast is sponsored by the FG Barnes Group, with car dealerships in Canterbury and Maidstone.
It's feared lorry drivers heading back to the continent for Christmas could cause disruption on Kent's roads over the next couple of days. Operation Brox in force on the M20 to try and limit delays. The AA's issued an amber traffic warning, as millions of people are also expected to be travelling to see friends and family. Toby Howe is from the Kent Resilience Forum, which plans for events like this.
The purpose for Operation Brox really is to be able to use, in effect, as a pressure valve for freight heading to the ports if there are any delays down there. So, for example, last Saturday morning, there were delays at the port of Dover. TAP, which is the control on the A20 between Folkestone and Dover, was put on. And to stop that filling up and causing problems in Folkestone, Brock can be used then to hold that freight further back, because as soon as TAP fills up, National Highways have to close the Roundhill Tunnel, Folkestone then becomes gridlocked, Dover gets affected as well. So Brock is all that the Kent Resilience Forum have available to us to enable us to hold freight back so that it doesn't cause any congestion further down the line.
And the idea then is that because you've got that contraflow, any other traffic heading to the port and to the Eurotunnel can still keep moving, is that right?
Exactly, yes. So the motorway can still function in two directions for all other traffic in the contraflow.
Does it tend to matter what sort of day Christmas falls on? Do you see that because it's on a Sunday this year, it changes people's plans at all?
Not really. You'll always have that rush sort of whenever Christmas does occur. So in particular, you get an increase of freight travelling back. So a lot of the European freight companies all want to get back home for Christmas. So there are more freight HGVs heading back to Europe this week as well.
I'm sure you're very pleased to have seen the snow melt away. The weather now over Christmas is looking pretty mild, but is it worth keeping an eye on the forecast as well if you're heading out?
It is indeed, because I think we've got some heavy rain due, and there might even be some more wintry showers sort of immediately after Christmas. So again, keep an eye on that. If the winds pick up from certain directions, it can affect the ferries.
We've spoken about the M20 and how that's set up to try and alleviate any potential delays. Are there any other potential hotspots in the county that you think drivers need to look out for?
Not really. I mean, luckily at this time of year, both National Highways and KCC Highways tend to put an embargo on certain routes to make sure that traffic can flow. The only sort of pinch point that is still there really is the top of the A249 Detling Hill meeting junction 5 of the M2. There are still works ongoing there, so there are still some delays there. But overall, the M2 is flowing towards the port, the M20 is flowing, so all the through routes are working, and the A2070 in Ashford has been cleared of the roadworks as well, so there's two-way traffic running both of those. So generally there shouldn't be any issues on any of the other routes.
Well, keep listening to our sister station KMFM for updates on any disruption, and you can also follow our live travel blog at Kent Online. It's claimed elderly residents have been left trapped in a care facility in Chatham because the lift is broken. It's been out of order for about 3 weeks, meaning people living on the third floor at Rogala Place with mobility issues and dementia are struggling to leave the building. Southern Housing, who manages the building, have apologised and say repair works have been delayed because of a national supply issue with replacement parts. Now, a man who almost died after contracting TB while living on the streets in Canterbury is going to feature in a new three-part documentary. Nick Chamberlain kept going to A&E because he was feeling so unwell but struggled to get treatment.
I had started to feel unwell and I'd been actually going up to QEQM to the A&E, you know, and I'd get to triage and I was that unwell. I was actually falling asleep in the waiting area, yeah. And there I am with a rucksack and I unshaven, obviously homeless. And I'm declaring myself as homeless, you know, when I turned up. And in you know, the jaded world that we live in and the overstressed, overworked and underfunded NHS, all they're seeing is a guy looking for somewhere to kip in the waiting room for a little while, keep warm and perhaps get a bed and, like, you know, something to eat and whatever. So I kept getting turfed out, yeah, and I was turning up every day, you know, trying to get past triage. But obviously, I'm really giving the wrong signals, you know. But I was going downhill fast. I really was, and you know, I mean, in the end, I felt so tired. I was exhausted by it, and exhausted by it. You know, I was on the verge of giving up, to be honest. And if it weren't for Joe insisting that, like, that, you know, I see the paramedics, yeah, and that's when they picked up on the sepsis. Yeah, it was the sepsis that was picked up on first of all, and then got me into the hospital, and then they found that I had the TB.
You ended up being the subject of this court order, which must have sounded horrible at the time, but as Joe said, it kind of did save your life because you then had that support back in place again. I mean, looking back, are you quite pleased that that happened eventually?
Looking back, yeah. I mean, as you say, at the time, I did feel very hard done by. I felt, you know, wrong, you know, to a degree. But it did. It enabled people to actually talk to each other who, up to that point, because of, like, you know, data protection and because of patient confidentiality and all these sort of things, they couldn't actually discuss me, even if it was, you know, two health professionals talking about treatment. They couldn't talk to each other if they were from different departments. Now, that can hold up a person's treatment by, you know, days or weeks, yeah, which can be, you know, it's you know, every day is important. But not just that. I mean, suddenly, it wasn't just my physical health that was being taken into consideration. It was also my environment. Like, you know, when I come out, what is, you know, what we're going to, where are we going to put him, and what's this going to do to his recovery and to his potential, like, for continuation, you know, with treatments and that. So everyone was started talking.
Because I think sometimes, Nick, with homelessness, perhaps we hear the statistics, but as you say, you're not a number, you're a person, and you need that, yeah, that support. Were you trying to get off the streets when you did become poorly first time around?
Again, I'd moved about, and in different areas, there's different sort of help available. Yeah, and I'd engaged with, like, you know, in different places, and again, it's like everything's just so overstretched that being a single man with no dependents, I was always very much a bottom of a heap. Like, yeah, there's always people more needy, or, you know, their need is greater than mine, and I understood that. And there's limited resources, limited people, and whatever. So, yeah, I always seem to, like, be at the bottom of the, you know, the back of the queue.
He was being filmed by Joe Spence, who was doing a PhD at the University of Kent.
So the documentary From the Cubby derives its name from a former homeless encampment that existed in Canterbury in 2016 and 2017. And that's where I met Nick, who at that time was a research participant, but is now with us today as co-director of the series. The Cubby was just the doorway of a derelict building on Story Road in Canterbury. When From the Cubby first started, it was intended originally as what was supposed to be just a 10-minute video. And I spent maybe 7 or 8 evenings with Martin and Nick collecting documentary film footage for that anticipated 10-minute project. What I didn't know at the time was that I was actually filming people who were exhibiting the symptoms of what later turned out to be TB. So I didn't know that what I was actually capturing on camera was the transmission of tuberculosis.
And how did that make you feel once you realised what was going on?
In Nick's case, Nick was taken to Margate QEQM Hospital in the February of 2018. A few days, he was initially taken because they'd identified sepsis, but after a few days in the hospital, they identified that Nick also had an active strain of Mycobacterium africanum, which is a strain of tuberculosis. And a one that's actually sensitive and responsive to the primary antibiotics. So it's treated. What Nick had was treatable, but of course Nick at that point has got to run the gauntlet of emergency accommodation. So Nick was forcibly detained for 6 months under what's called a Part 2A court order that falls under the 1984 Control of Diseases Act. And in a strange way, that Part 2A order was the best thing that could have happened to Nick. We were faced with this very, very rare situation where all the different services, from housing services to mental health services to substance misuse services, all had to meet in a courtroom every month to deliberate as to what they were going to do with this Nick, who for them was a very, very complicated patient. In a strange way, the courtroom and the activities around it fostered a situation where all these different agencies that often find it difficult to communicate were deliberating as to the specific needs of Nick's care. That gave Nick an actual first real opportunity, in my view. He'd had to address addiction, start moving forward and start rebuilding.
He covered Nick's story for 5 years and helped him get life-saving treatment. Nick is now in a council house and is hoping to work with Joe to change how homeless people's medical care is dealt with. Elsewhere, a homelessness charity has told the Kent Online podcast that they fear more people will be out on the streets in the new year because of the cost of living crisis. Figures from Maidstone Homeless Care show the number of people in need of food parcels has reached more than 300 a month. It's prompted the organisation to bring back their You Can Help campaign in a bid to get more donations to meet the growing demand. Reporter Carl Simmons been chatting with Tracy Maybank, who's the assistant manager.
Overall, it's just really mainly supporting the homeless people. So they can come in, they can have a shower, you know, they can eat, they can use the computers, the phones. We've got the laundry. Yeah, and we also have vulnerable people in. So they're sort of a few people we've got that just cannot cope being on their own. Because a lot of them, when they do move off the street, they find it difficult because their kind of social network out on the street, believe it or not, they do kind of stick together out there. That goes and they get into their housing and they're very like isolated. So we give them that little bit of support for a few weeks to settle them in. So
I was just going to say, obviously, you've had COVID-19.
Yeah.
Which the guys were saying, obviously, was a massive impact with them.
Yeah.
And now you've got the cost of living.
Yeah.
It's like one thing after another.
I mean, before we are on appointment basis, so we book them in. So we're around 10 coming in a day. But the bonus from that is we can work a bit more solidly with them. You know, we can give them more one-to-one working. And the idea of that as well is that the council should be picking them up and housing them. But yeah, that's a bit of a tough one, that, because there is a lot out there still homeless.
And do you think that because of the cost of living, you know, obviously everyone's affected by it, but
absolutely,
do you think people might possibly, you know, become homeless because of it? I mean,
oh, I think so. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, we've got families at the moment, obviously we're doing the food parcels, but we've got families that are like looking at, do we go without food? Do we put electric on? Do we pay the rent? You know, it's harsh. So I think that come New Year, I think that's just going to ricochet. I think that's just going to build.
Why do you think it, obviously, it is going to be difficult this year for people to help other people when they've got... But I mean, what does it mean to you for people to just donate even like tins of food or clothes?
Massively. Anything that anyone donates here gets used. And, you know, it goes a long way. So anything that anyone out there can give us, tins, anything, fruit, veg, would be helpful. But like you say, are people going to be able to do that? Or is, you know, so there's that worry. That's that grey area that we don't know yet. Fortunately, we're rolling. It's okay. But we'll see.
On our website, you can find details on how to support their appeal. George Cohen, one of England's 1966 World Cup winning footballers, has died. The 83-year-old, who lived in Tunbridge Wells, played every minute of the team's campaign, including the final against West Germany. He spent his entire career at Fulham, making 459 appearances. The Premier League clubs say he was one of their greatest ever players and a gentleman. Kent County Council has been criticised for closing down one of their offices in Ashford to save money. The building on the Henwood Industrial Estate will shut at the end of January, and staff say they're shocked after being told over Teams on Monday morning. Bosses have blamed enormous pressure on their budget, but employees say they'll now have to pay higher energy bills as they work from home. A businessman who's trying to turn a pub near Canterbury into a Turkish restaurant says he regrets buying it because it's costing so much. Plans to convert the middle of the road in Surrey were approved last month, but no work can be carried out until rotting joists are replaced. The owner reckons the building would have fallen down if he hadn't bought it, but says they're under a lot of financial pressure. And a Kent historian's been giving us her predictions for what will feature in the King's speech tomorrow. It's the first time he'll deliver the special Christmas message since becoming monarch. Nicola's been speaking with Dr. Emma Hanna, who's a lecturer in modern British history at the University of Kent. She says he has a lot to live up to.
The royal family are at Sandringham traditionally every year, and I think the decision to take it to television was certainly a move to modernise the royal family and the way it approaches, you know, the way it talked, it spoke to its subjects. I mean, certainly Prince Philip was a real force for modernisation, and certainly through the 60s. And I think that's probably one of the elements of the crown that is closer to the truth, is this feeling that they were worried about being seen as out of touch, and that they should use the new medium of television because it's so more immediate.
I think there's always a lot of speculation as to what the Queen was going to say, depending on what had happened throughout the year. But would you say she always seemed to strike the right kind of note with her Christmas speech? I mean, are there any that particularly stand out, would you say?
I think 1997, after the death of Diana, was difficult. And obviously she'd had Annus Horribilis as well, when Windsor Castle burnt down. I think that was 92, wasn't it? And two of her children got their respective marriages ended. So Charles and Diana and Anne. And Captain Phillips. So I think probably those were particularly difficult for her. I mean, certainly that is the purpose of the speech, to sort of sum up the main events that had happened throughout the year. And I think she is seen to get, Queen Elizabeth was seen to get increasingly more personal and a bit religious as well. She would introduce more religious aspects into her speeches.
And of course, this year it will be a first Christmas message from the King, and only three months after his mother passed away. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be quite difficult for him personally, but what are you expecting from King Charles this Christmas?
This is the year where he isn't going to be allowed to speak on causes as much as he was allowed to under the Prince of Wales. And I think that's already been alluded to in the media. So, you know, a lot of the causes close to his heart, like the environment and sustainability and farming, he may well try and want to put some things of that kind in the speech.
Yeah, I'm wondering if there will be reference to the Queen at all in his speech. I mean, I'm sure we'd all expect there to be some sort of reference, whether it's what he says or visually. We sometimes look at what they place behind them, don't they, with pictures and things that are on display.
Yeah. Yeah, the big Christmas tree is part of the course, of course. And then, yes, there's always a lot of focus on which family members get, you know, the prime spots in the camera. I mean, I think the grandchildren will be very, I'm not sure the word Netflix will feature that much, either for The Crown and particularly the recent documentary by Harry and Meghan. It would be quite interesting to see if there's a picture of them in pride of place.
And of course we now have a queen consort, whereas the Duke of Edinburgh didn't play quite as much of a role in, like, he certainly didn't appear in the Queen's speech with her. Would we expect queen consort Camilla to play any kind of role in this festive message, do you think?
I really don't know about that. There's always archive footage that they'll use. You know, and the monarch's voice is used as voiceover over that footage. So I'm sure that he will probably pay tribute to a lot of the work that she does, the little charity work that she does.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one. Will you be watching, Emma, on Christmas Day?
I do. I actually do like, you know, I'm not some ardent monarchist. You know, it's just you know, part of the job with looking at you know, British history, 20th century British history and culture. You know, there's a lot involved in there with the royal family. But like many people, it's a nice punctuation mark on Christmas Day. You know, 3 o'clock. You've normally had your lunch. You normally can't move for a bit, so you're sort of if you know, so you're sort of sitting there digesting, and it's that sort of mid-afternoon Christmas Day. You know, all the, you know, most people have opened their presents, they've eaten a lot of food, and they're ready for a bit of a sit down and a bit of TV time. And certainly that tradition is very important.
And you can hear the speech on our sister station, KMFM, at 3 tomorrow afternoon. Well, that's all from us for today and for this year, but we will be back in 2023. Thank you ever so much for listening. And if you're celebrating, have a super Christmas and New Year's. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and TikTok. You can also sign up to The Briefing to get a daily update of the top stories each morning. Just head to kentonline.co.uk.
News you can trust.
This is the Kent Online Podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the FG Barnes Group, with showrooms in Canterbury and Maidstone, offering a range of new and approved used cars, including MG, Seat and Vauxhall.